back to the Equipping You in Grace podcast. My name is Dave, and I'm the host for this podcast. And I get to welcome back my friend, Dayton Hartland. Dayton, welcome back to the Equipping You in Grace podcast, man.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me on again. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. Hey, can you just catch us up a little bit on what's going on in your life, marriage, ministry, you know, some of the current ministry projects that you're working on?
Yeah, man. We've got a lot going on. Our church is, as I mentioned before, we're in the middle of a transition to a permanent space from being a mobile church plant. We've got a couple of neat things in the pipeline. We're trying to start essentially, we're calling it the Redeemer Institute, which will be an opportunity to earn actual Bible college seminary credit hours on our campus and classes. So it's a lot going on, a lot of balls to juggle, but it's all good. And family life is great. All three boys are happy and healthy, and coming out of flu season here and nationwide, but it's hit real hard in North Carolina, and we're good. So praise the Lord for that.
Would you please tell us about your book, Church History for Modern Ministry, Why Our Past Matters for Everything We Do, why you wrote it, and how you hope it's received?
Yeah, so this book actually came out of, I've loved church history for years and years and years, and it really changed my life once I started to see the value of church history, and just that we don't need to reinvent the wheel, and our forefathers in the faith have gone through some of the same things we've gone through, and started to just really learn about what has shaped the various traditions that we hold to in different denominations and different circles, theological circles. Really helpful for me. And that really spurred on me from being a student in church history and historical theology courses to really wanting to make that my kind of field of study. And so I did. And then I went from studying in different degree programs, church history and historical theology, to teaching it. And what was interesting is being someone who has learned church history, and there's so much more I can learn, but particular, you know, areas that I study, I saw such practical implications of it for my ministry. And yet what I found, and as I was teaching different classes, is I have to spend so much time explaining to students, particularly those that want to be pastors or church planners or missionaries, here's why this actually matters. This isn't just so we can get you a history class in or information. This will shape the way you serve in whatever capacity the Lord has you serving. And so I would sometimes lecture, like, on end, classes on end, like, hey, no, here are all the reasons why this matters. All this is not just info. Taking some of those notes just kind of turned into a little book. So it's like, man, I don't need to take lectures on this. We can just, here's a book. Read this brief book that walks through all the ways that church history ought to be shaping your ministry. And it should shape and will shape whether you're aware of it or not.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was definitely different than most church history books, in a good way, not a bad way. You're like, different. Oh, man.
Yeah.
You didn't like it. No, it was good. It was good. And I've heard of it recommended by other people, and so I was like, hey, I need to check this out.
That's encouraging. Yeah, I appreciate that. Cool.
So, you know, C.S. Lewis talks about chronological snobbery. So maybe we'll just start out there. What is chronological snobbery?
Yeah, well, there are definitely technical ways you could approach it, and C.S. Lewis did such a good job with it. The way I like to talk about it and think about it, I love movies, and chronological snobbery is, in essence, you just believe whatever's new is better. But to put in perspective how ridiculous that is, if you held to that consistently, you would have to say that Jurassic Park 3 was better than Jurassic Park 1. Jurassic Park 3 had a talking dinosaur. If you've ever seen it, a talking dinosaur in Dr. Grant's Dream. Terrible movie. Jurassic Park 1 was awesome. You would have to say that the prequels for Star Wars were, you know, that The Phantom Menace was better than A New Hope. I mean, no. But chronological snobbery would say whatever's newer is better. And we do that as Christians. We think that with the latest books are better than older books. The whatever new theological emphasis is present in, you know, the blogosphere or whatever it may be, that's what's important. And what was discussed in the past isn't. And it's just not true. It's just not true. The notion that what came before is inherently inferior to what is present. It's just not true. And Jurassic Park 1 to Jurassic Park 3, point in case. Jurassic Park 1, great. Jurassic Park 3, terrible. But chronological snobbery would say, no, whatever is newer is inherently better.
Yeah, I think that Christians today can do that because they don't really know. You might hear them say, well, maybe not so explicitly as this, but, you know, well, you know, that's just what you think, or something. Mm. So we have like a Christian relativism or something like that.
Yep. Yeah. You know? Absolutely.
And so then why would we study, you know, our Bibles or church history or something like that? I think that's another form of chronological snobbery in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
What you think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's before I mean, I had a bad case of chronological snobbery before I really jumped into it, in particular the early church fathers. I just saw no reason to study it because of this, that I had in my mind divorced my theology and my practice from everything that has come before that inherently shaped my theology and my practice.
Yeah.
And so once I saw, man, there are these guys post-New Testament writing things that about things that matter to me 2,000 years later and wrestling with the same things. And so much of my theological vocabulary has been actually, oh, wow, they were talking about it 2,000 years ago. Okay, so that's not new. That's actually really old. And it became really helpful to me. And so one of the reasons why I would say everyone should study church history is, I walked through a number of reasons in the book, is just that your theology and your practice did not form in a vacuum. They were shaped by influences and cultural challenges and the questions being raised by the culture that had to be answered by the preeminent theologians of their day. And we're busy constantly trying to reinvent the wheel or act like we've arrived and everything before us was garbage. When in reality, if we look to the past, it makes the present a whole lot simpler to understand and navigate. So it's incredible practical daily value for Christians in looking to church history.
One example I like to use, I was invited by a prominent apologetics ministry when I lived in Boise, which, you know, I told you I had just moved there, you know, so this was like a couple of years ago. So I was, you know, going around talking to people and there was a Jehovah's Witness. Well, I know what the Jehovah's Witness is going to say. He doesn't believe in the deity of Christ like Mormons and all that. So, but I always ask him anyway, who is Jesus?
Yeah.
And he said, I don't believe in the Jesus that you believe in. I don't believe in the Bible that you believe in either. Whoa. That was a lot of stronger answer. There was a reason.
Yeah.
He was upset that people were doing open-air preaching and those kind of things.
Yeah.
Separate to the point. So I said, so what you're telling me is that what we believe doesn't really matter. That doctrine doesn't matter. He's like, yeah, what I believe doesn't matter. It's like,
wow.
why are you even out here? You know, because you're whether you know it or not, you're preaching what you believe in. And I said, and then I walked away after I said this, because I could tell he was getting upset, and I wasn't trying to upset him. I was just trying to have a conversation with him. Anyway, I said, no, sir, actually what you believe actually matters, and, you know, doctrine matters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And anyway, later on, this other gentleman came and talked to him. I mentioned what the interaction. He said, ooh, that sounds fun. I'm going to go over and talk to this guy. So then long story short, at the end of the interaction, he says, well, at least you weren't like your friend asking, you know, questions and being rude or whatever. And I'm sitting here standing right there. He said that right to my face. And I'm like, I wasn't rude. All I did was ask a question and make a few points and walked away. You know, I wasn't trying to be pushy or whatever. I wasn't even trying to convert him. I was just trying to engage in a conversation with him and hopefully point him to Jesus. You know, and give him a few things to think about. That was really all I was trying to do. But, man, he was really upset. But that's just an example. You know, why? Why does that matter? Well, how did I know that? Well, from studying church history.
Yeah.
I knew to ask the question because I had studied, and I knew what the history of the church was. So I knew that his position was wrong, not because it was personal, but because this is what the church has taught from the Bible. So
for sure.
That's kind of a good segue is to ask this question. Why should Christians study church history?
Yeah. I could I would love just read through some of the book. Basically, I mean, it really is that every little thing that we hold so dear theologically, I mean, it was forged out by debates in the church, engaging with people who were teaching false doctrine, particularly early in the life of the church. Everything that we would hold near and dear as the essentials of our faith were forged by men and women who bled and died, believing them and teaching them and sharing them with others. And so at one level, it's because these are blood-bought doctrines. I mean, we ought to know, at a historical theology level, how did this come about? But then also, everything we do in our Sunday morning gatherings that we just do reflexively without even thinking about it has some kind of historical basis to it. There's a reason why Christians have done these things. For instance, our church, we periodically will do a corporate reciting of creeds or portions of confession. And it's a great opportunity in those moments before we do that, whether it's the Apostles' Creed or Nicene Creed, whatever it may be, to kind of introduce our congregation to the forefathers of our faith and where they were and what they did. And in particular, in one of the benefits is, and this is just a kind of a fringe benefit, but it's a huge benefit to the study of church history, is we've gotten to this place where, unfortunately, we've minimized the inherent diversity, and I'm talking ethnic and cultural diversity, that's been present in the body of Christ from the beginning. And in particular here in the West, often we tend to have this very narrow view of the church where, because this past Sunday I was able to quote from Athanasius and talk about, I mean, he's a bishop from Africa that shaped so much of our understanding of the nature of the Godhead. And man, how great is that? That's wonderful that we've had all these different voices through the ages. And you understand by studying church history better what your church does on Sunday mornings. You'll better understand why some of these doctrines that we hold as the essentials of the faith are so important. And then just at a cultural level, there are many practical implications, but one of them being just it reclaiming a healthy, robust understanding of church history and historical theology will also push us towards kind of embracing and celebrating the inherent diversity produced by the gospel, breaking down dividing walls of hostility and uniting all people in Christ. And because you'll see that just all over the tapestry of church history, just this beautiful, beautiful picture of people of all backgrounds and nations and tribes and tongues being a part of this grand story. So it has wonderful practical implications for sure.
Yeah. That's really good. How do creeds serve as orthodox guardrails for theologians and pastors?
Yeah, it's interesting. So we love the creeds in our church, and we love the creeds in part because the creeds are just faithful summaries of the Bible. They're just faithful. They're theological statements in short, memorizable form. Throughout history, from time of Christ, shortly thereafter, I mean, you have the Apostles' Creed bubbling up from among God's people really, really early. We kind of have these, this is the boundary of our theology. We can disagree about the details inside of this and be orthodox, I'll be brothers and sisters, but once you go outside of the bounds of this, so you mentioned, you know, Mormonism and Jehovah's Witnesses, they go outside the guardrails of the creeds. What they believe outside of the creeds, contradictory to the creeds. And so it's a different faith. It's not our faith. Our faith is outlined by the content of these creeds. And so it's really helpful, I think, for pastors, particularly early on, to familiarize themselves with the creeds, is knowing where the creeds came from and why their statements are so important will protect you in your preaching and teaching. One of the examples I give in the book is a guy I knew who his ministry was very divorced from church history in terms of not knowing what had come before. And so he thought he was seeing stuff in the Bible that, man, no one's seen this before, which is always a huge red flag. When you're seeing stuff no one's seen before, probably wrong. and he meant well, but he started teaching long condemned heresies and didn't know it because he's unfamiliar with the historical development of certain doctrines and how quickly, how early what he was believing and espousing was actually taught among the heretics in the early era. And so it can help us in our preaching and teaching, just in our theological development, to know, okay, here are the guardrails. We can explore these things and even disagree brotherly in a familial way about the details inside of this. But if we're inside of these guardrails, we're on the same team, we're the same family, maybe different traditions, different theological circles, but we are believers. We're united in Christ. And so it's super helpful for the ministry of a pastor in that way.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really good. What is the difference between creeds and confessions? And what is a catechism?
Yeah. Creeds are just, as I mentioned, just kind of big picture guardrails of our faith, theological summaries of the Bible that are in memorizable form. Whereas confessions tend to be longer. They tend to be more detailed. So whereas the creeds give you the guardrails of your faith, the confessions kind of give you the contours of your particular theological tradition. And it's super helpful for us to not just know the guardrails of our faith, but then once you kind of embrace a particular theological circle or tradition, if that tradition has a confession, you can kind of see the contours of that tradition through the confession, which tends to be very detailed on very specific doctrines. So those two things are different, but they're helpful and complementary. And then you got catechism, which is more of a question and answer, discipleship, Bible memory, theological memorization tool. It's super helpful for families, for churches. Our church, we practice catechism with our kids in our kids ministry. We encourage families to do it, which is interesting. If people are unfamiliar with that term, when they go through our membership class and we tell them, we will catechize your children, and they kind of, wait, what? You'll do what? You know, it sounds painful and scary. It's like, no, we're just going to help them memorize gospel truths. We want to partner with you as you do that. And so these are all things developed through the history of the church that are of great importance and great value. And unfortunately, much of contemporary pop culture Christianity has forgotten all of them. Yeah. And it's to our detriment.
Yeah. How has the early church values of gospel, community, and mission shaped your local church Redeemer?
Those three things are the core values of our church. We filter everything we do, the way we spend money, prioritize different aspects of the ministry of our church, kind of we filter them through those three things. Because what you see among the first Christians, I mean, starting in the book of Acts and then kind of branching outward throughout history, the first Christians were committed to really those kind of three things, kind of contoured, shaped the rhythms of their life. Acts chapter 2, you've got 2:42 through 47, we're told that the first believers devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching. Well, the apostles' teaching at that point was basically the gospel, primarily the gospel. They're certainly showing how the Old Testament pointed to Jesus, absolutely the deity of Christ, and making clear the Old Testament. But a huge chunk of it really was, this is the gospel. This is the good news. So their lives were centered around this good. They were devoting themselves to this good news. And then they were just living their lives together, relationally, communally, eating meals together in one another's home. And so we've made the rhythm of our church not just to come back to the gospel constantly, but to live our lives together in community. And then lastly, in that same block of text, I find it fascinating that it says that God was adding their number day by day. And in the midst of all that, it talks about what they were doing day by day. Day by day, they were going to the temple. Day by day, they were eating meals together. They were just living life together, doing what they normally do. And yet, evidently, they were doing it on purpose as Christians, living on mission, seeing all of life as missional, because in the course of just living their daily lives, people were coming to faith in Christ. So that whatever they did it on purpose. And so for us as a church, we like to say, we borrowed this from Steve Timmis and Tim Chester, that we're just ordinary people living ordinary lives with gospel intentionality, because it seems like that's the rhythm of the early church. And so for us, in looking back at the book of Acts, and then shortly after the New Testament, the early church, seems to be this rhythm of, we center ourselves in the gospel, we live our lives together, and then we see whatever our vocation, our role in life is, we see it as the mission field Jesus has given us. And so looking back on those things has huge practical implication for 21st century. First century church ought to be influencing the 21st century church.
Yeah, that's really good. Why is it so important to be mentored in ministry, and what does that look like in your own life?
It's important to be mentored in ministry primarily because we have no idea what we're doing until we are mentored in ministry by people who didn't know what they were doing until they were mentored in ministry, and so on and so forth. We ought to be constantly being discipled. We never move past the need to be discipled by someone. And so particularly in the bounds of ministry, we need seasoned pastors and ministry leaders, missionaries, you know, discipling us and mentoring us. And so in my own life, what that looks like is I have pastors, man, that I harass, probably isn't the right word, but I harass regularly to say, what do I do? How do I handle this? And so I have a regular rhythm of communicating with those brothers and asking them dumb questions and hard questions and important questions, and meeting with them regularly next week. Even just this upcoming week, I'm going to be meeting with some brothers to ask them to pour into my life and my ministry to help shape me and show me where I'm coming up short. And so it needs to be, the rhythm of the early church was devoting ourselves relationally to one another, to build one another up in Christ. And I think we've missed that a little bit in ministry. We wrongly think we don't need that. And in reality, that needs to be the rhythm of every Christian's life, whether he's a pastor or Sunday school teacher, church leader, whatever it is.
Yeah, that's really good. You know, I think it was 4 years ago or something where Mars Hill collapsed, or maybe 5 years ago. Mm. And I, growing up in Seattle, and actually attending there for a number of years.
Oh, wow.
It shook me because, you know, God used Mark in my life.
Yeah.
You know, his preaching was dynamic and it was, you know, great, those things. And so it really shook me when, you know, Mars Hill collapsed, and I realized, gosh, with the gifts that God's given me, not in the same way as Mark, obviously, but, you know, leadership, preaching, teaching, those things, and visibility and those kind of things.
Yeah.
Gee, that could be me. You know, I could be controlling and manipulating and all those things.
Absolutely.
And, I said, all that to say, I said to my pastor, I said, I need help. And he had already been pouring into my life at this point in the relational area and saying, you know, you need to work on this in humility. And I said, you know, this really opens me up more to what you're saying.
Mm.
And, that kind of engaged a process where I really just grew a lot, you know, to the point where, you know, I was able to deal better, much better, be much more patient now than I was 5 years ago. with difficult people.
Mm.
I was able to process things in a healthier way. I've been a Christian a long time, you know, and even been to seminary and been in ministry, but it was like, again, it wasn't the knowledge thing, it was the application of it.
Yeah.
Learning more to, like, apply those things relationally. And it really, really helped me to deal with difficult things in my life, to walk away when I'm upset and be okay with that. And just to say, hey, I need space to process this. Or I need to walk away because I'm getting upset. And being okay with sharing that and just communicating more. He would tell me, you know, more communication, not less. More communication.
That's right. That's
more
right.
Communication, not less. I got it. Yeah. It took me a while. It took me a few years. More communication, not less. And now more communication, not less, please.
Yeah, that's right. There you go.
It's kind of funny. But, you know, that, you know, I've been mentored from high school on up, and I believe that. And but that really helped me, you know, just to realize, you know, I have things to grow. And it was, you know, this thing that happened that really helped me to see that, you know, I needed this. I needed to grow, and I needed to see things in a different way. So I really appreciate what you said about mentorship. I believe it. You know, we just talked about in our previous interview about being open and transparent and just really letting people speak into your life and not being prideful and having walls and just letting that come down. And that's what people, I mean, even non-Christians appreciate that.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
So I grew up in Seattle, and they just want to see a real Christian being, you know, saying, hey, you know what? I got stuff in my life, and I got crap in my life.
Yeah.
Just like you. I have Jesus. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do preachers and teachers of the Word address the presuppositions of our hearers and help shape their worldview of Scripture?
I think we've got to be cultural exegetes first. And if you look throughout history, you see some of the greatest preachers, some of the most prolific authors in the history of our faith, post-New Testament, really, really understood the culture. And so they could speak to the assumptions of the culture, what the culture is presupposing about truth, presupposing about sexuality, presupposing about even just in general authority claims. And so looking in particular at church history, we can kind of see models for this. We see models even into some of the letters that we have that have been written, some of the dialogues that are recorded, super, super helpful in seeing how to do that. But the main thing being to follow the pattern of the early church and then forward of understanding what's actually happening in the culture, what people are assuming without knowing they're assuming is true about reality. And then as you're preaching, preach with a view toward engaging that, whatever that presupposition is, on whatever subject it may be, with sexuality, authority, truth, the nature of truth. Everyone that's listening to us on Sunday mornings or whatever the setting is where we're communicating God's word has presuppositions. Everyone has presuppositions, and it's just important to know what the prevailing cultural presuppositions are, so that you preach to them and not past them, that you're not preaching to your own presuppositions, but you're saying, okay, here's what likely the majority of people in this room or this gathering are presupposing about life, and so that you're engaging that thoroughly.
Yeah, that's really good. You know, I just think, like, growing up in Seattle and even in living in, you know, Idaho for a decade, it's just asking people questions.
That's right.
I can give a recent example. There was a lady... lots of homeless people where I live. I mean, it's just overwhelming, really. It's sad. I used to go down to Seattle, downtown, to minister to homeless people. Mm-hmm. And there's just so many more homeless people here. It's just really sad. But anyway, there was one lady at the post office. Well, I have a P.O. box because I don't want to get people steal things here. I mean, they just take it right off your, you know, front step. So I have a P.O. box because I get a lot of books and whatever from publishers, and that's fantastic and whatever. You know, I'm a book nerd like you. And so, you know, anyway, there's this lady, and she asked me, you know, how are you? I'm selling some things for my thing. And I'm like, it's probably not good. But anyway, I asked her how she's doing, you know, have you eaten and those kind of things. And I just felt like I needed to take her for lunch. Well, there's a place to eat right next to the post office. So then I was like, just buy her food and then she can go. You know, thinking this in my head. And anyway, so then she comes and is sitting in the booth next to me. And I'm like, gosh. So I move all my things. Because clearly she wants to have a conversation. So we have a conversation, right? And I ask her a bunch of questions. She says that she's been abused. Well, I stop her and I said, do you want to stop that cycle of abuse in your life? And she's like, I have no idea what you're even, I can tell. She had no idea. And that opened up an opportunity to share Christ with her, you know, after I asked even more questions about this, to understand really what's happening in her life. And I think that just asking, you know, whether we're counseling or whatever, whether we're reading a Bible, studying for a sermon or whatever, I just think asking good questions is part of loving God. We're called to love the Lord with all of our heart, with all of our mind, with all of our soul. And so we got to love God by asking good questions, you know, and actually listening when people are talking, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's just so undervalued in books. there was a book by Matt Anderson, I think it's Matt Anderson, published by Moody a few years ago, and it's a good book, but there's not much written on questions. People view questions in the wrong way. They think, well, if I question things, I'm going to be considered like an unbeliever, or that's just unbelief. And it's like, no, asking good questions because you have sound and convictions is actually good. Now, having bad convictions and then asking, you'll ask the wrong questions because you have the wrong convictions. You have the wrong theological beliefs. So if you have good theology, you will actually ask good questions. I don't see a lot of people talking about that in the church. I think that's unfortunate. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, no, I agree. Question asking is a lost art, and particularly in the early church. That's one of the reasons why I love early church fathers, is you see in their writings that they're constantly asking questions, not necessarily in a, you know, verbal dialogues, so we have written material from them, obviously, but they're, even as they're just writing reflectively, theologically, they're asking questions, and it's fascinating to see them wrestle with different things. Well, does this mean this? And if Christ does this, then what does this mean about his? And yeah, question asking is a lost art, and it's good for cultural exegesis, and it's good for our own theological development. And if you look at the span of church history, periods where you see, I think, the greatest leaps in theological development and ministerial development tend to be periods where you see prominent Christian thinkers pressing the bounds of various issues through really healthy questions. I think that's important. Yeah, you know, we lost the art of asking good questions.
Say some more about that.
Say some more.
Say more. I'm interested. Say more.
Yeah. No. Even Augustine's writings. I mean, you could spend forever mingling through that. Through everything he's written, you see some of his, you know, forays into Trinitarianism, just some of the illustrations and analogies he uses, and where he's trying to figure out how do I best, you know, illustrate this reality that is logical and consistent but transcends material experience. And it's fascinating to see him talk about, is it kind of like the love relationship? And he just starts, you know, all these different directions. And then you come to folks who, Origen, I think people are a little too hard on Origen, but he really wrestles with some questions, and some of them get wild and wacky really, really fast. But just seeing these people who have shaped our theology, even practice so much, grapple with some heavy, heavy questions. I mean, even the Council of Nicaea, you know, the question being raised by Arius, as he is just talking about Jesus being a creature, he's got little rhyming ditties that he shares to get people just to memorize his doctrine, and then coming out of that, the Nicene Creed. Well, the Nicene Creed is forged in part because you had all these essentially pastors gathered together asking really hard questions. How do we express this clearly and consistently? And so you see good things come from healthy questions. I think that's an important point. We've lost the art of asking good questions.
I just ask that because I ask you to say more because, you know, people don't even think about that, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so little written about that in blogs and in books, contemporary Christian literature as a whole, that I don't think we could just say something about that. And so I ask you to say more because there's so little written.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
Yeah. Why is contextualization in apologetics and preaching so important?
We are in... we've moved even past the postmodern society here in the States to, I don't even know what you would say, but we are a postmodern society. Words, understanding your context is important because the words you're using are probably not the same words that are being interpreted by your listener. Understanding, which gets back to presuppositions, understanding what people are assuming about words, about truth, about reality is vital. And so one of the healthiest practices then in a culture that is naturally skeptical in the worst possible sense, not in the healthy sense like, hey, I want to see how this plays out, but like in a we should question everything except questioning everything kind of culture, it's evolved into kind of absurdity in that way. Instead of just talking about marriage, going to Ephesians 5, we get to talk about how is the male-female relationship that God has designed it such a way it is an illustration of the gospel. So you get a little apologetic for why do we talk about the husband and wife relationship and not just generically marriage, because that term has changed culturally just in the last few years. You talk about, I mean, you can just go on and on and on. You talk about the birth of Christ, whether it's, there are obvious places like the resurrection of Christ. You should go at least some semi-apologetically periodically as you preach and teach that. But our culture inherently assumes we're wrong on virtually every truth claim, except maybe love your neighbor. Yes. And so it's necessary that we understand why we believe what we believe. And again, looking at church history is helpful for this because we think we're in a hostile culture now. It's nothing. I mean, they fed our forefathers and our mothers in the faith to lions for sport. It's not that bad here. And so we have the freedom to do so. We should explain ourselves clearly, apologetically often. And see the early church as a model for that. Many of the early church fathers would engage culture in a way that was masterful. And so seeing how they did things apologetically in their writing and preaching, it could be a model for us, I think.
Yeah. I mean, look at the Apostle Paul, what he did when he was in Athens, right?
Yeah.
He was frowning, looks. Why does
exactly.
he do that?
Exactly.
Why does he do that? To get to know the culture.
Yeah.
You know, and then what does he find? The temple or the altar to the, excuse me, not the temple, the altar to the unknown God. Right?
Yeah.
I do know my Bible sometimes.
That's
right. You know, but I really appreciate how you're stripping it down to the most basic thing. I was talking to my wife about a project that I want to work on. It's like, what do you think? I think that I have to strip this down to the most basic thing because people don't even know the Ten Commandments and the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount, which that's what the statistics say, then we have to strip a thing down to like the most essential level, whether that's, you know, for a Christian on a Sunday or even especially that's even more true for a non-Christian who doesn't even know anything. So I really think that that's a very astute observation that you just made. So, why should Christians today recover the vision of Abraham Cooper and others on cultural engagement?
Yeah, and you have my friend, you have Bruce Ashford on the other day, and I know he is a Kuiper guy, if there ever is one, and I'm sure he could talk about this forever, and so I don't want to say something that he would then need to correct me later and say, you got that wrong. So I guess let me say this.
And he does listen, by the way. So
if he's listening, I hope I get this right. No.
Hi, Bruce.
No, I've really appreciated. I mean, there are things that I think Kuiper gets wrong, but there are a lot of things he gets right in terms of seeing all of life is inherently touched by our faith. All of life is inherently worship. That we Christians ought to be culture producers. Christians ought to produce art. Christians ought to influence the government. Not that Kuiper would not, you know, advocate necessarily a theocracy that some would. Could advocate in different theological circles, but he would advocate that Christians ought to be influencing the way the government runs for the purpose of human flourishing, that we ought to be influencing the way entertainment is produced, again, for the purposing of human flourishing, and that there's just this emphasis on human flourishing, and that we engage the culture to see holistically every aspect of culture changed by the gospel, and then ultimately reflecting gospel ideals and gospel values, whether it's the way we work, what we produce in our work, so you can get out of work ethic, to how we educate people, to the purpose of education. And so you start looking back throughout church history, and you see these just different rhythms, whether it be from the Reformers, whether it be, go back to, again, Augustine, who I know comes up a lot, or then jumping forward to someone like Abraham Kuiper, that just sees that the gospel, if you believe the gospel, it ought to change your entire worldview on everything. It's holistic. There is no sacred secular divide. Everything is sacred. And since everything is sacred, everything ought to be shaped in such a way that it honors the Lord, brings glory to Christ. Even you know, Kuyper was an educator and a governmental leader, and there should be this influence at every sphere of life that produces a recognition of the Imago Dei, how God has wired us, how God has made us for His glory and His image, and then ultimately all of culture pushing us back to directionally recognizing Christ as Lord of everything, of every inch of everything. So looking at folks like him can help us shape, okay, now how do we, moving forward in a clearly post-Christian culture, how do we begin to reclaim this Christian worldview of there is no sacred secular divide, everything matters, everything's important, everything ought to be influenced by, shaped by, and ultimately reflective of the gospel we believe. So Kuyper can be helpful for that, for sure.
I think Dr. Ashford would approve.
If he doesn't, you can email me, Dr. Ashford. Thank you.
But I thought that was a good answer, my opinion.
There. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. How can pastors help Christians negotiate the present and help them prepare for the future?
We obviously have no idea what the future will hold in so many ways, whether it be religious freedom, whether it be cultural trends, whether philosophies of the day, shifts in morality. But we can look to the past and see how Christians have navigated these things in the centuries before us. In particular, I think of in the Roman era, navigating a hostile government, navigating a sexually perverse culture, navigating competing truth claims. And what you see that I think would be helpful for us is this inherent confidence that Jesus wins, the gospel is our hope, and even as Jesus says in Mark 5, as he's about to raise a little girl from the dead, and he tells her father, do not fear, only believe, that it, as the culture around us shifts and changes, those are words that ought to echo in the hearts of Christ's people. Do not fear, only believe, I'm going to make this all right one day. And in the meantime, pastors can help their congregations, the church bodies they serve, navigate the future, I think by directing them to the past, that this isn't anything that comes is nothing. There's nothing new under the sun. And we've always thrived. If you have people who are afraid of the marginalization of the Christian faith, well, we thrived when we were being fed to lions, when we were the most marginalized of people. And in fact, it's probably when we when we have no opposition that we're in the most danger, because then we become comfortable and it's gone poorly historically. But I really think looking to the past can help equip pastors to know how to navigate what's coming down the road and just to keep this steady confidence. Jesus is coming back. Jesus wins. He's going to make it right. You know?
Yeah, I think that's really good. So outside of your book, you know, what book should Christians read to begin their study on church history?
Man, there's so many good ones. Zondervan and Baker both have these excellent multi-volume sets on church history that I would highly recommend diving into. They're kind of a text that's been around many years and is used in a wide variety of theological and educational circles. From Justo Gonzalez is helpful. It's very informative. There's a book called Church History in Plain Language that could be great for someone who's just diving in. It's very useful. I recommend looking up authors like Michael Haken. He's written a lot of great stuff. And then an author who's meant a lot in my life personally and really kind of stoked my love for reading Augustine and just seeing the missional efforts of the early church, Ed Smither at Columbia International. It's got a lot of great resources. So wide swath of them. In the back of my book, I have tiers. I have a reading guide, and then tiers of, if you're a beginner just diving in, pick these books up. If you want to go deeper on this subject, this period of history, pick these books up. And so even if you don't buy the book or read the book, you can go to Amazon, probably look at that page and see somebody else's book that you should pick up. But there's just so many good resources. We're so blessed to have so many good resources in church history available.
Yeah, that's really good. You know, we've talked about a lot in this interview. Just wondering maybe if you have a couple takeaways or maybe four or five that you want our listeners to take away as they go and pick up your book.
One of the things that, actually, I just kind of give you kind of one, I think. Sorry.
That's okay. You're disappointing me, but that's okay.
I know. I hate that. One of the things that church history has done for me is really instill humility. Mm. And I think one of the most practical implications and applications of church history is just humility. We all tend to be very impressed with ourselves, unfortunately. And when you read church history, you come away from it not that impressed with yourself, because you kind of see who you are, that you're just one individual who, by God's grace, gets to be part of this grand story of redemption that he's writing, and you just get to be part of this story. You get to be part of this wonderful, wonderful story of the people that he's bringing together, that he's writing and weaving, and so it's this humbling effect. So, oddly enough, what I would say is if someone is really struggling with embracing humility, study church history. It'll make you a far more humble person.
Hmm. That's a really good point. Well, Dayton, man, I really appreciate the time that you've given to me today for this interview. I've really appreciated hearing, getting to know you through your answers, and just pray Christ's precious blessings on your ministry, brother.
Hey, thank you so much, Dave. I appreciate it, man.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Equipping You in Grace. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving a rating on iTunes and share it across your social media outlets. I want to thank you once again for listening to this episode. Until next time, may the Lord richly bless you and keep you.